Indeed, this morning, we appreciate your presence into this place of assembly, and I would be ungrateful if I did not likewise express my sincere appreciation for the presence of those of you who are here. There are several who are visiting with us, and we want you to know that we are especially appreciative that you have taken time out of your journey or in regard to the invitation that someone has extended to you to come and to be with us this morning that we might worship together the God of heaven. We are looking this morning at the emptiness in some of our own people by virtue of the holiday weekend that is here, because what we are doing is we have just celebrated, as it were, the founding of our country. It is over 215 years of age now, and certainly with the kinds of principles that we see in America, that is cause for celebration. We realize that there are people that are still waiting in line to come into this country. There are many of the things that you and I talk about, sometimes complain about, that we are anxious in regard to as our nation continues its journey, fearing that there are some things that are going to erode away the very foundation principles on which our nation has not only been built, but has lasted for over 200 years now. And yet, when it is looked at by others in the world, the things that you and I take in citizenship in America today for granted is something that they desperately long for and desire, and that they are willing to do just about anything in an effort to be able to become and be a part of American society. While we were in Orlando this week, there was a report that into the Miami area there had been a trailer that would have been hitched to a semi. It had been sealed up, in which eight Puerto Rican men in their early 20s had paid their way to try to illegally enter this country. And because it had been sealed up so tightly, by the time the ship on which they had been located had reached the shoreline of this country, that already five of those were dead. And the other three decided that they'd better do something, at least to get some oxygen into there, or they likewise were going to be dead. And with some very primitive kind of means, they began to try to get some hose in this container in which they were in to get a little air to circulate so that maybe their lives could be preserved. There were three of them living when they started that project, and by the time it was completed, only two of them were now alive. They had paid what to them would have been a king's ransom just to try to get into this country. And I say all of that to say that these are the kinds of things that we are somewhat familiar about. We hear continually of people who are trying to get into the country to enjoy the blessings and the privileges and the freedoms that you and I take for granted. And it indicates then that when we think of our nation, that it is cause for celebration. The very basic rights that we have are still respected. There are few restrictions that are placed upon us and upon others who are a part of our society. And yet I say all of that so that I might take us this morning for just a few moments into the scriptures to remind us that this is a privilege that basically we have of God. And I want to go back. We're studying on Wednesday evening from the Proverbs, and I would suggest to you that in the 14th chapter of the book of Proverbs in verse 34, there is a passage of scripture that we want to use as the primary thought of our study this morning. It is a familiar passage to most of us that says, "Righteousness exalteth a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people." What the writer has to say here is something that needs to be indelibly impressed upon the minds of those of us who are a part of American society today. That righteousness is what it takes to exalt a nation. It does not matter really how much flag waving we have. It does not matter how much basking in the glow of victory like Desert Storm that we might be able to have, and all of the thoughts of patriotism that may fill us because of the events that have taken place within the last 6 or 9 months as our nation has waded its way through a rather difficult time. It does not matter how many patriotic speeches might be able to be uttered. It does not matter how many military bases that we have and that we fund, and it does not matter how many planes or ships or how many men that we can not only amass together, but we can arm them and send them out. That's not the basis of our continuance as a nation. The writer says that it is righteousness that exalteth a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. This certainly does not say that those other things will not in one way or another enter in. But we need to be reminded constantly and continuously of one fact that you can see especially drawn in the pages of the Old Testament, and that is that no nation is indestructible. That includes the United States of America. For example, when you turn back to the pages of the Old Testament, you will notice that there are a number of instances where God deals with a number of different nations. Egypt, for example, was one of them. You know, Egypt, we as Bible students are very familiar with. After all, it entered in very early into the contact of the history of the nation of Israel. And it was in most of the Old Testament days a thorn in the side of the people of God. So often it was that there was oppression in one way or another that the nation of Israel suffered because of the various rulers of the throne of the Egyptian kingdom. It was for a period of time the very height of civilization. It was a gift of the Nile. It was the leader in science and knowledge and education, in civilization. For a period of time, it was identified as the granary of the world. You are very familiar with that by virtue of the story of Joseph and his being sold by his brothers down into the land of Egypt. And yet how that all of this worked for the preservation of the family of Jacob. Not only the preservation, but the fact that God says in a statement that you and I probably more connote with Jesus that was spoken initially of the nation of Israel, and that is, out of Egypt have I called my son, was spoken of the nation of Israel first, because 70 went down in. But a mighty nation is that which Moses led forth under the direction of God. The 2.5 to 3 million people minimum are those who came out after that period of bondage and slavery. And yet they went down in because there was food there when there was famine in the rest of the world. There was food not only for the Egyptians, but other nations now were coming in. The gift of the Nile and its overflowing and its enriching the soil with the silt that had come as it had journeyed its way down through, with its irrigation canals that enabled them to grow a great deal of grain, produced within them the kind of thinking that often is thought about of America today, that it is the nation that fed the world. And yet, when you look at Egypt even today, the Nile still is a mighty river, one of the mightiest in the world, and it still amazes those who are there. And yet those who have done work in searching through the records of the past, that have tried to delve into the present, have looked at the situation and say that the Nile River does not anywhere near support the kind of agricultural program that it had in the past, that it was much vaster in days gone by, the period that we are more familiar of in the pages of the Old Testament. And yet of this nation, God writes, for example, in the 13th chapter, or the 19th chapter, I'm sorry, of the book of Isaiah, or the two chapters that we want to look at just a moment here in Ezekiel, in chapter 29 and 30. You need to be aware that when, at least here in Ezekiel 29 and 30, that God writes through his prophet Ezekiel in regard to the nation of Egypt, that a man by the name of Hophra is the Pharaoh that rules on the throne. He is a very proud Pharaoh. He will rule for a period of 25 years. He ascended unto that position of rule when he was very young, and with him came the pride and the arrogance that is often associated with somebody that you might think of whose power has gone to his head. And here was a man who made the statement that no God could deprive me of my throne. In other words, I am here. There is no man that can take me off. And he was arrogant enough to say, not only can no man take me off, but there is no deity. There is no God anywhere who could take from me what I possess. And I tell you what, that's just about like casting down the gauntlet before God. And God said, oh yes, there is. And in the 29th chapter, for example, in the first couple of verses, read with me. In the 10th year, in the 10th month, in the 12th day of the month, the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Son of man, set thy face against Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and prophesy against him and speak against all Egypt. Notice that the prophecy that is spoken here is not only in regard to this particular Pharaoh, but as well to the nation of Egypt as well, because it had likewise imbibed that same kind of a spirit that said that we are invincible, that there is no army, there is no nation that can rise up and be superior to us. There is nobody who can defeat us, not only among men, but there is no God that any man would serve who would be strong enough to cause us to revoke the position that we presently have. And so God says, yes, there is, and it is I. In verse 8 of the same chapter, therefore, thus saith the Lord God, behold, I will bring a sword upon thee, and cut off man and beast out of thee. And the land of Egypt shall be desolate and waste. And they shall know that I am the Lord, because he has said, the river is mine, and I have made it. In verses 14 and 15 he says, and I will again bring the captivity of Egypt, and will cause them to return into the land of Pathros, into the land of their habitation. And there they shall be a base kingdom. It shall be the basest of the kingdoms. Neither shall it exalt itself any more above the nations, for I will diminish them, that they shall no more rule over the nations. God raises nations up and uses them for his own purpose and end, and he allows them to stand. But when they develop the spirit and the attitude that was characteristic of this Pharaoh, as well as what had now drifted down into the people as a whole, God is able to say that I'm going to deal not only with the leadership, I'm also going to deal with the nation as a whole. That there is no righteousness that exists therein. There is no acknowledgement of God. There is no respect or reverence or awe of deity anymore. And as long as that continues, then I will deal with that nation. The one thing I want you to see about Egypt is that God did not say that he would destroy it to where it would exist no more. But rather, he said that he would make it a base kingdom. He would bring its power, its prominence, its influence down. He would bring it low. He would make it to where it would not rule over other kingdoms of the world, because Pharaoh did not know the true God and his power. It's amazing that this would take place in the days of Ezekiel, isn't it? I mean, after all, you'd have thought they'd have learned their lesson in the days of Moses. I mean, you remember when Moses went in and he said, for God, let my people go. And Pharaoh looked at him and said, who is the Lord that I should serve him? Or that I should fear him? Who is the Lord? I'm God around here. My word is law. I'm not going to do it. And the plagues were the result of the attitude that was manifested, and Egypt was brought low on that occasion. That same kind of spirit that Moses had to face has developed and risen again to its highest sublime, to where now one more time, God this time deals with them, but says that they will not be a prominent nation ever again. He would make it the basest of kingdoms, desolate in the midst of desolation. There would not be any longer the ability to rule over others. And so, you look at today, and that's exactly the kind of situation that exists. Later, God would say that he would also make the land less productive over in the 30th chapter and in verse 12. I will make the rivers dry and sell the land into the hand of the wicked. I will make the land waste and all that is therein by the hand of strangers. I, the Lord, have spoken it. And as we've already pointed out, historically, it had been demonstrated that that's exactly what's taken place. No nation is indestructible. Look at another. This one maybe is not quite as prominent in our thinking as Egypt would be or Babylon would be. But look at the city of Tyre. You know, when you think about Tyre, you think almost of its sister city, Sidon. There were prophecies made against both. The prophecies were not the same. Sidon was said to have been destroyed, but it would be able to rebuild itself. Tyre, on the other hand, was a city that was going to be destroyed and laid desolate and made waste. And that's exactly what God had done. You can read these prophecies in a number of places. For example, the 23rd chapter of the book of Isaiah. You can look into Ezekiel in the 26th chapter in the first 28 verses, as well as in the 9th chapter of the book of Zechariah. And when you start reading, one of the things that you'll see here is that in Ezekiel 26, for example, beginning in verse 7, that God makes the statement not only that the city would be destroyed, but notice God said who was going to be the destroyer. For thus saith the Lord God, behold, I will bring upon Tyrus Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, a king of kings from the north with horses and with chariots and with horsemen and companies and much people. He shall slay with the sword thy daughters in thy field. And he will make a fort against thee, and cast a mound against thee, and lift up the buckler against thee. And he will set engines of war against thy walls, and break his axes, shall he break down thy towers. By reason of the abundance of his horses, the dust shall cover thee. Thy walls shall shake at the noise of the horsemen, and of the wheels, and of the chariots, when he shall enter into the gates, as men enter into a city wherein is made a breach. With the hooves of his horses shall he tread down all the streets. He shall slay thy people by the sword, and thy strong garrison shall they go down to the ground. And they shall make a spoil of thy riches, and a prey of thy merchandise. And they shall break down thy walls, and destroy thy pleasant houses. And they shall lay thy stones, and thy timber, and thy dust into the midst of the water. And that's exactly the way it happened. Nebuchadnezzar came against them and destroyed them. Oh, they rose up and built again, but God had said later that there would be a second destruction, a final destruction of the city of Tyre. This would come in the days of Alexander the Great. When Alexander had reached the portions of Tyre, you remember Tyre had its relationship with Israel. You remember Hiram, the king of Tyre, how that he had such a good relationship as it dealt with David in his latter days and later with Solomon. It was this king that supplied a great deal of the cedars of Lebanon in which the temple was going to be constructed. And yet now, here's a city that God says, a civilization that ultimately will be laid waste. In the days of Alexander the Great, he did that. When Alexander comes to town, his army really is not that powerful, it appears. He has not sent his full force against the city of Tyre. Maybe it was the fact they resented it. Maybe they felt that here, because his force had been divided, they would be able to freely defeat the difficult situation that they faced. What they did was, they retreated from the mainland to a little island fortress that they had just offshore. And they figured, go ahead and sack the city. Go ahead and destroy what's on the mainland. We'll rebuild that. We've done that before. But you can't touch us out here. We're safe out here. We're surrounded by the sea and by the strong walls. There's a strong garrison here. The pitiful force that you've got just cannot be victorious. You cannot break in. You're vulnerable. And you remember, militarily, some of you may have studied, that what Alexander the Great does here stands as one of the very great victories militarily in the history of men. Alexander took the challenge. And what he did was he leveled the city. And having leveled the city, he picked it up block by block that they had used to build what they owned and took it out and cast it into the sea. And he just built his own causeway right out to their fortress. Now it cost him because they were exposed. But unbeknownst, I know, to Alexander was the fact that God had already prophesied. What they had cast into the sea became the very means whereby they were able to make their assault, in which they were able to finally break down the walls, to enter into that final garrison and lay it waste. And Tyre remains a desolation. God said that it would become a place where the fishermen would spread their nets and repair them. And that's exactly what's taken place. Ezekiel 26 and down in verse 5. Or you think of Babylon. Babylon was one of the eight wonders of the ancient world. A marvelous city. It was a city that had reached its height of pride and glory. It was a magnificent city in its structure. It had two walls around it. The outer wall was 350 feet high, and the inner wall was 250 feet high. These walls, they were convinced, were impenetrable. And the distance between those two walls was great enough that you could take seven chariots and line them up side by side and let them run all the way and navigate all the way around the city and never touch one another and never touch the walls. They were safe. In the construction of their city, they had taken the river and diverted it under the walls so that even in time of siege, there would be water there. One of the things that always caused problems, you know, whenever you had days of long siege, generally of trying to starve you out or to make you so thirsty you just couldn't last any longer, they'd made provisions for all of this. And yet God speaks about them as well in the 13th chapter of the book of Isaiah, or the 50th and 51st chapters of the book of Jeremiah. Maybe the best thing to look at and see the downfall of the city begins under the great king Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 4 of the book of Daniel and the 32nd verse. Because here, this man had been ruling and he had finally pretty much controlled as much of the world as he was going to be able to control. And he was walking in his palace and surveying his kingdom. And he said, look at what I have done. Everything that is because of me. I am it. And God said, before the words had finished coming out of his mouth, that here's a man who needs a lesson and I'm going to teach it to him. And for a period of time, you're going to be as the beast of the earth. And you and I'd say that what he did effectively was he went crazy. And they took him out and they fed him, as it were, as one of the beast. And his hair grew to where he was like one of the cattle of the field. And his fingernails and his toenails grew to where they looked more like claws or hooves rather than fingernails. And the dew of the morning was upon him day after day after day. And at the end of that appointed time, the scripture says in the 4th chapter of the book of Daniel that his reason returned to him. He got his priorities straight again. And he realized that it was not he, Nebuchadnezzar, who had produced this, but rather that God permitted men to rule among the affairs of men. And it was because of God that he held what he held. And because of that, God restored him back to his kingdom and to his former position of prominence and power and glory. And he remains there during that period of time. It's interesting that when you look at the 5th chapter of the book of Daniel, it looks like, even because in the words of Belshazzar there, he talks about Nebuchadnezzar as his father. In reality, it is skipped a generation or two. There has been a number of years past. You have gone from Nebuchadnezzar in the very first prominent, powerful king when the kingdom is set up, to the very last one in chapter 5 in Belshazzar. Belshazzar rules as a co-regent with his father. His father was more interested in being an archaeologist than in being a king. He was always off digging up some ancient religious relic somewhere. And during the days that these events come to pass, when the kingdom falls, that's exactly where he is. And Belshazzar, his son, co-regent, is the one who's reigning with the powers of authority in the city. And I would suggest that when you look at chapter 5, you're familiar with the events, how that he's got a drunken feast going on. During the days of the feast, he decides that what he's going to do is to send somebody over to one of the warehouses and to have them get all of the gold and the silver cups that his father Nebuchadnezzar had collected that had been from the temple in Jerusalem, and to bring them in and to fill them up with wine, and they'll use those as a put down of the nation of Israel and of Jehovah in this drunken feast. And you remember that while they're doing this, that a hand appeared and wrote upon the wall, "Meeni, meeni, tekel, upharsin." And you remember that, I guess, is enough to sober anybody up. Some of those fellas see pink elephants. This fella sees a handwriting on the wall. The only thing is, the handwriting is actually there. And he sends for all of his wise rulers and he says, whoever can tell me what that means, I'll give him a new suit of clothes. And I'll give him a gold chain to put around his neck. And I'll give him a third of the kingdom. They come in and they look at that and they're stumped all together. Not a one of them who can figure any of it out. And finally, one of them is smart enough to think back. And he says, you know, in the days of Nebuchadnezzar, there was a fellow that was a Jew from the nation of Israel that was brought over here, that was a very prominent person. And if I remember right, he was an interpreter of dreams to Nebuchadnezzar. Maybe he can tell you what it means. And they send for Daniel. And remember, Daniel comes in and he says, if you can tell me what that means, I'll give you all. And Daniel looks at him and says, forget it. I don't want it. You can give it to somebody else. The main reason Daniel knew what it meant was, this is the last day for this kingdom to stand. You can tell me I'm going to be a third of the ruler of this kingdom, but I'm only going to rule for whatever's left in this day. It falls tonight. And he looks at him and he says, I'm not interested in that, though ultimately it is all bestowed by Belshazzar, even after Daniel interprets, which is amazing considering the interpretation. But you remember how that he looks at him and he says that the days are numbered, that the kingdom is fallen. It'll be given into the hands of the Medes and the Persians. And it took place just exactly that way. In fact, they came in, we would say, without firing a shot. The provision that they had made for water in the days of siege had been diverted. The Medes and the Persians had been outside of town, and what they had done was to dig a canal. They diverted the river water. And so secure were the people in Babylon that even the people who were on guard duty were drunk. It was such a great celebration that Belshazzar was having. They felt so safe and so secure that they just didn't think anything could happen. And Darius led his army right down that riverbed, right under the walls, and they walked in without firing a shot. And the great city of Babylon was laid waste. And one of the things that God said in regard to that was that it would no longer be a habitable city. And it's not been. He said that it would be a place where even the shepherds would not take their flocks to graze them. And they don't. It's interesting to note, a few years ago, I heard Brother Farrell Jenkins speak after one of his tours to the Middle East. And he had gone to where the ruins of Babylon lay. And he said that as he talked with the group that he took in regard to that, and they read some of these prophecies from the scriptures, that the guide, after he got done, called him over and said, I've got one preacher you can add to your list. And he said, well, what's that? He said, well, the other day I brought a group out here, and they don't believe what you believe about that Bible. They believe that it's not true. And they came out here, and they quoted that passage, and then they went out and got some shepherds and hired them to bring their flocks in here, and they took pictures of them, and they're going to go around saying that this is the way that it really is around here. He said, but I thought I'd better tell some of you one thing. As soon as those fellows disappeared, the shepherds and their flocks left. And he said, well, why is that? He says, because this place is considered to be haunted. Now, that just shows the end. Some who oppose God and his word will go in an effort to try to disprove the prophecies of Scripture. God said, it'll be a place where the wild beast will be. And he said, not only that, but it's going to be a place where people who pass by and look that way are going to shake their head. You can almost hear them go. To think about how marvelous a city that had been, how great a city that had been. And now it lay waste. All because, as Daniel told Belshazzar, you did not learn the lesson of your father Nebuchadnezzar. You're weighed in the balances and found wanting. Well, there are other cities that we could look at, but what I want to suggest to you primarily is that maybe from all of this we can see what the proverb is trying to say. Righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. What we've got to recognize is that just as John says in 1 John chapter 3 and in verse 7, that God is righteous and man should strive to be that same kind of righteous being. Little children, let not man deceive you. He that doeth righteousness is righteous, even as he is righteous. And you know, that's one of the things Peter learned, wasn't it? When he went to take the gospel for the first time to the Gentiles in Acts 10, in verses 34 and 35, that he learned that in every nation he that feareth him and worketh righteousness is the one who is going to be accepted of God. We need to recognize that righteousness is the key. It is the key to preserving a nation. And I'm convinced that I'm talking to people this morning who are the key to preserving America. If you want to keep America strong, it doesn't really center in all of the kinds of things that politicians tell us about. It centers in how much righteousness is going to be left in this nation. It starts with people like you and I. It starts with the realization that when you live that righteous, godly, holy, upright life that God expects, that you're doing more than anybody else in preserving this country. And when the righteousness runs out, I don't care how many nuclear weapons we've got. I don't care how many Star Wars defense systems we've developed. And I don't care how many men we can arm. It'll be lost. Righteousness, God says, is the key. And in every one of these instances and the others we could look at, every nation that was defeated because of a lack of righteousness that existed within it. And I say this because sometimes some of us who are Christians feel like we're not doing enough. We're not doing the right thing. Sometimes even some of these televangelists get on and they try to get us to see that this is what you ought to do or that's what you ought to do, and you need to join this crusade and you need to join that crusade so that you can get out here and put pressure on doing all of these things. It doesn't start there, my friends. It starts with being righteous, even as He is righteous. It means bringing your life into conformity to God and His revelation. And when we do that, we're doing what we ought to be doing to make our nation the strong nation, at least in the eyes of God, that will enable it to stand. What is it that God requires of the nation to bless them? Listen. One of the things is He requires that they acknowledge Him as God. Nineveh was destroyed because they were told to acknowledge God, and they refused to do it. Nebuchadnezzar said, no, until he was brought low. Belshazzar said no and wouldn't be brought low. The Pharaoh of Egypt said no, and the nation said no, and God brought them low. Our nation is based on the very idea, at least was founded, on the concept of in God we trust. We've put it on our money. But you know, currently in this country, there is a great push to try to take it off. It is the idea that somehow or another, that means that government and religion have interfaced one with another, and it just has to be removed from there. We've removed God out of a great deal of our society. We do that, and it's another step down the primrose path that will lead to destruction. Furthermore, God has always required justice of a nation that He blesses. He has always required that nation be one that will render justice. In Amos, for example, in the second chapter in verse 6, the righteous were sold for silver. God has always required of civil government. He's not authorized any particular kind of civil government, but of whatever civil government it might be that men erect, He has always required that there be justice in that civil government. That it not be something that can be built, that it not be something that can somebody can buy their way around the justice system. It's not that way, not with God. He requires that men be just in their dealings one with another. And not only that, He requires morality out of its citizens. He requires that we recognize His right to rule insofar as it pertains to those specific areas of the kind of lives that we live so that righteousness is what's seen in us. And you know how sad it is that all of these things in this country are under attack. That in some ways there's an ebb and flow away from the principles of God in all of these areas. And it's the reason more and more that we need to think in terms of what it is that God has said will exalt a nation and enable it to stand, the righteousness of God. Are you here this morning as one who is righteous before God? Or are you here this morning as one who's given yourself to that which you have determined to be right? Or what others have told you to be right? Are you aware of the fact that God has revealed in the pages of His Word the very things that will make you right before Him? And that's what counts. And so if you're here this morning as somebody who's not obeyed the gospel of Jesus Christ, we want you to know that the opportunity is available for you this morning to be right with God. Jesus makes His plea to come unto me, all you that labor and are heavy laden, and I'll give you rest. There is an opportunity for every sin and iniquity that's in your life to be removed. That what will be in its stead will be a covenant relationship with God, the right to identify yourself as His child, citizen of the kingdom of heaven. It's yours. It's within your grasp right now. But it requires the same thing that it required of Nebuchadnezzar, and he was willing to give. It requires what was unwilling to be given by Pharaoh, by Belshazzar, and by some other nations. That is the humble spirit that says, I'll do what God requires or what he requests. Jesus said, he that believeth and is baptized shall be saved. He that believeth not shall be damned. If you're willing this morning to believe and be baptized under the remission of your sins, you can leave this place right with God, because that's what the Lord said. You can listen to somebody else. You can listen to the wisdom of men. They'll attack it. They'll tell you it doesn't mean what it says. But in the last day, it will still say exactly what Jesus said in Mark 16 and verse 16. If you've not lived as you should have, don't allow unrighteousness to be your life and lifestyle. Yield rather to the righteousness of God. That's revealed in the gospel, Romans 1, 16 and 17. Renew your covenant relationship with the Lord. Be right with God. That's the plea while we stand and sing.